Hello and welcome to Week, the news commentary program from the Commonwealth Club of California. We're coming to you from the Adobe Systems campus in downtown San Jose. This is the first time we've held a week-to-week up here in, in San Jose, but we've had about half a dozen of them up in San Francisco. And the purpose of this whole series was to try to do political discussion and commentary and interaction without the kind of shouting matches you see on TV. You know, we can be, what does Bill Clinton like to say, we can disagree without being disagreeable. We've had a great deal of fun with him up there, so we hope you will enjoy this one down here. And just a note, we're going to be expressing opinions left and right, and we're going to give you guys a chance to express opinions. So any opinions expressed today are those only of the speakers, certainly not of the Commonwealth Club, our members, sponsors, next-door neighbors, anything else like that. So, and there should be question cards around. Please write comments about anything we discuss, because at the end of the program, we're going to try to read as many of those and get a good two-way discussion going here, because we've got lots of fun stuff to talk about. So let me introduce our panelists for today. I'll go from your left to your right. On the end there is Barbara Marshman. She's a veteran journalist, currently the editor of the editorial pages at the San Jose Mercury News, and you can follow her on Twitter at Barb Marshman. Next to her is Terry Christensen, a professor emeritus at San Jose State University. He's a specialist on state and local politics. He's the author of numerous books and is currently working on the 12th edition of California Politics and Government, which he co-authored with Dr. Larry Gersten, who is a frequent panelist on Week to Week. And right next to me is Kirk Hansen, the executive director of the Markula Center for Applied Ethics at Santa Clara University, where he is also the John Courtney Murray SJ University Professor of Social Ethics. Does that all fit on one business card?
That all fits on one business card.
Multi. In addition, he's an emeritus faculty member at Stanford University's Graduate School of Business, and a little later in the program, he'll be going more in depth on what might seem like an oxymoronic topic of ethics and politics. So let's get into the news of the week. The main topic we have to talk about, obviously, Justin Bieber throwing up on stage. No. How many of you saw or heard the debate last night, I assume? Let me take a poll. And I guess for the online audience, clap. How many of you thought Mitt Romney did what he needed to accomplish last night? Okay. How many, and those aren't necessarily mutually exclusive, how many of you, thought Barack Obama accomplished what he needed to accomplish last night? One person raised their hand. Yeah, that does seem to be the consensus that I've been seeing as well. Panelists, I'll maybe start with you, Barbara. What were you most interested in last night when you were watching?
Well, I was just stunned to see the president, who as a campaigner 4 years ago was so inspiring and so eloquent, and just wonderful rhetoric in the best sense of the word, rhetoric. Mm-hmm. I just don't know what happened to the man. There must have been a strategy to be reserved and presidential and perhaps hope Mitt Romney made some mistakes, which he's been prone to do. But golly, he should have revived sometime through that. I was stunned at the performance.
Do you think he was specifically staying away from some of those kind of mentioning the 47% sort of things that would have been kind of like point scores but maybe weren't presidential enough to be bringing that up?
I think I wouldn't be surprised if he deliberately stayed away from the 47%, because that is so out there. And to me, if he brought it up, it would give Mitt Romney a millions of people forum for him to put his spin on it. So I wasn't surprised to hear that not come up. I did think in the few times he tried to get at Mitt Romney's record, like the Mitt's comment that kids who want to go to college should borrow the money from their parents, he did it in such an oblique way that if you didn't already know what that was about, you wouldn't have even understood what he was saying. So the few things he did try to counter, he just didn't do a very good job of it.
Terry, how about you? What?
I, too, was stunned by the president's performance, but also by Romney's performance, which was extremely, extremely good. Glib, not entirely truthful, but a very effective debate performance. He did, as our audience and all of us agree, I think, he did what all but one agree. He did what he needed to do in the debate. The president, that's where we disagree. If you think about those two guys as job applicants and you're HR and you're doing the interview, which one would you hire? One guy is, okay, he's kind of glib, but he's enthusiastic. He's very articulate. It's very clear he wants that job. The other guy is smart and substantive, but kind of morose. And who would you hire? I think most HR people would hire Mitt Romney. Now, of course, the other question is, who would you really like to work with over a long period of time? the glib, over-articulate, over-eager guy, or the calmer, quieter guy? I guess the other thing that stunned me was that this is not the Mitt Romney that we saw in 16 debates in the Republican primary series.
Yeah.
That was not the severe conservative, right, as he called himself, during the primary cycle. So that's a whole new Romney, or it's the whole old Romney, or we don't know quite where to place it.
There was a lot of fun made of the comment by one of the Romney campaign people months ago that doesn't matter what he's done during the primaries, there's an etch-a-sketch when
etch-a-sketch,
you get to the common,
yeah,
the main campaign, and you start anew. Was this an etch-a-sketch moment where he was able to, I mean, President Obama, I think, wasn't able to kind of break through and make any point, the point of, you know, this, you're not saying the same things you said 2 months ago. There was always a response to it. So was Romney effectively etch-a-sketching?
Oh, well, effectively is the key word there, and I don't know the answer to that.
Yeah.
He was etch-a-sketching, so this was a different Romney. What remains to be seen is how people and voters particularly are going to react to this. I think it was also kind of a dull debate. And I bet a lot of people didn't make it all through the 90 minutes, and I bet the viewership was lower than past debates have been. So I think ultimately it will have less effect. But having said all that, Romney did what he needed to do to get himself back in the game. Because before this debate, the momentum was with Obama. Coming up in the polls, it looked like his campaign had the energy and the enthusiasm, and this could be a game changer if people were paying attention. If they were paying really close attention,
then,
and that's a whole other question.
Yeah. Sure. I think this demonstrated what has been Obama's weakness from the time he became president. Yes, I think his performance in the last campaign in 2008 was quite good. But unfortunately, as president, his rhetoric has been less than sterling. He did not tell the story of the medical care reform. He did not tell the story of the stimulus package. He did not find the right words to paint a picture and create a sense of understanding where he was going to the American people, which led to some of the weaknesses that he encountered politically during the first term. So I found this to be, just because I am a Democrat, discouragingly consistent with his performance over the last 4 years. And so I do think he failed to demonstrate that he was in command of things last night.
I think you're right, but on the campaign trail for the last 4 weeks or 4 months, he has been much more articulate, and he has been making that case. So we know he can.
Yes.
He didn't.
Terry was making the point of, if this were a job interview, how would the HR person approach it? One of the things an HR person probably does is check up on what the person said. I know this is one of your specialties. So what? Give us the truth squad review of last night.
Well, the first thing I was thinking when Terry was saying, if you were an HR person interviewing these two, but having taught 23 years at the Stanford Business School and dealing with the MBA cohorts there, I've developed a pretty good detector for style and less substance. So I like to think I can separate those. There were enough examples last night, really on both sides, of the truth being, if not mangled, completely broken. And Unfortunately, as I tallied it up at the end of the night, mm-hmm. about two-thirds were exaggerations or untruths by Romney and just a few by Obama, but there were some that were stretching the truth by Obama. So from that standpoint, I think Terry's right. If people really look at the specifics of what was said, there are, you know, they may come away with a sense of there being a lot more questions about where Romney stands. And, you know, who knows how people react to the Etch-a-Sketch phenomenon, whether they're glad he's moving back to the middle or are horrified by the fact that he's willing to take on whatever persona is necessary at the time.
Go ahead, Irene.
There was one particularly confusing thing he did, I thought, which was bringing up the pre-existing conditions. He said, again, as he said on Sunday morning television a few weeks ago, that his plan would cover pre-existing conditions, his health plan. And immediately after he said that a few weeks ago, his campaign jumped in and said, no, we would continue what's out there now, I guess the 1996 law that says if you have continuous coverage, if you go from one job to another, then you have to be able to, but not the kind of thing Obamacare was doing. And last night, Romney again insisted that he covered, and it was clear what Obama was talking about. So things like that, when, as we sort them out, and they didn't turn up in the overnight fact check, I think people will start, if they continue to stay focused on the race and don't just pop in for the debates, I think things will sort out a little more.
The kinds of stretchings of the truth or untruths even, do you think this is more, I mean, part of it is, you're on a stage, you're answering a question. Yes, you've rehearsed answers to any possible question you can be asked, but you're still on stage reacting to a dynamic situation and a moderator who looked like he didn't want to be there. I hope he brought a book, really, because there wasn't much for him to do. But, I mean, how much of that, in other words, is, look, I don't have 30 minutes to explain the details of my program, and so, yes, there's going to be a bit of a gloss here, and how much of it is, you know, look, this just ain't true. I mean, do you have examples?
I've got examples, and at least in my mind, these were rehearsed phrases that raised some factual questions. And like Barbara's example of whether people with pre-existing conditions will be covered or not, you know, putting aside the question of whether you can have such a system covering pre-existing without having the mandate, which economists tell us you can't, but something like that. There was the Romney comment about no higher taxes for high-income Americans, lower taxes for middle-income Americans, and we will deal with the debt without explaining that, without explaining how that's possible. Again, that's been pointed out repeatedly in recent weeks about, you know, that doesn't hold water. And so there was it was a rehearsed line, a rehearsed position. The line about accusing Obama of doubling the federal deficit. Well, the federal deficit before Obama came in office was already $1.2 trillion, and he didn't double it. It's basically held at about a trillion or slightly more since that time, but it isn't a matter of Obama having doubled it. So those things are central to Romney's appeal. The examples from Obama accused Romney of proposing a $5 trillion tax cut. Now, Romney does say, and Obama didn't acknowledge this, that he's going to have some offsetting taxes. But, of course, Romney is not telling what those offsetting amounts are. And so that wasn't brought out. But I think, in general, the lines that were most problematic were rehearsed lines.
Interesting.
So it was done on purpose.
Yeah.
And I think that's something that's changed, and Kurt's going to talk about truth and ethics and campaigns in a few minutes. But I think the candidates and campaigns feel much freer to just lie, to not tell the truth, on the assumption that they won't get caught by enough people or that there won't be some authority that will absolutely disprove their telling an untruth. And that's partly because of the change in the media environment. So if you're watching Fox News, there's one set of truths. And if you're watching MSNBC, there's another set. And the mainstream media, and then all the other, and the Mercury News, and then all the other online sources. And that's a big change. So I think it's easier for candidates to say things that aren't true or to exaggerate grossly and not really get caught.
I think the traditional media, I guess I lump newspapers in with that, we've all become kind of obsessed in this election cycle with truth checking, with fact checking. And I watched the debate at my office. I was tweeting, within a half hour after it was over, the New York Times had published posted a fact check. Now, we did one very quickly, or I think it was done by Syndicate and the Sacramento Bee. I got a bulletin. Everybody was trying to do it in a hurry. Now, the more in-depth fact-checking, the kinds of things that, you know, that we're talking about here, going to take a little bit of time, but I think there's a consciousness out there that nobody's been doing that, mm-hmm. and there's an attempt to fill that void.
And yet, I think the point that Terry was making, that who cares? the fact that there are now at least three fact-checking organizations by nonpartisan groups, and that they award liar, liar, pants on fire awards mm-hmm. to the worst. Another of them awards whoppers as the award for the worst lies. Doesn't seem to affect either the electorate or the candidates.
Do you think any different this year where, you know, the undecided vote, is very, very, it seems to be very, very small. You know, Romney's core is pretty much locked in. There's no way they're going to vote for Obama. Same on the other side. You know, they're not going to vote for Romney and the Republican Congress they're attaching to that. So, you know, is anyone in this room going to switch your vote because your candidate said something that doesn't pass Kirk's test? You know, I mean, the penalty, even if those kind, you know, if people are noticing it's not true, well, what am I going to do? You know, really? It may mean that I do care, but I can either, not vote or vote for the other liar.
Mm-hmm. Well, and either way, it can strengthen the commitment. I think one of the results of this debate and the series of debates that could have significance is an impact on voter turnout. Mm-hmm. So if Romney continues to do well and gets good spin from the debates, that really helps him in terms of turning out his committed electorate. And if Obama doesn't do better in subsequent debates, if there's a loss of energy, he's in big trouble. He needs that high voter turnout. So the perception of the debates can really have an outcome on the ultimate results of the election.
Okay. Well, let's wrap up this part of the section with what do you think each of them needs to do in the next debate? Starting with you, Barbara, what should Romney do? Should he do the same thing, or should he pivot knowing that Obama maybe is going to?
Well, he'll probably have to prepare for a more aggressive Obama, but I agree Romney did what he needed to do, and if he can keep up that demeanor and that ability to respond in everyday language and not talk down to people, I think he's doing a great job. I think he's misrepresenting what his positions are on paper, but he is presenting himself as the moderate the editorial for tomorrow morning. What we saw last night was the Massachusetts moderate Romney.
The guy
it's
who
not
worked
Romney
well with
we've
the
seen
Democrats.
Before. Now, Obama, I think, has to get back some energy, you know, drink some coffee, get going. One of the blogs I read today had a great line of Obama appeared to be, while Romney was answering questions, doing Sudoku. He's got to engage, and he has to prepare better. I don't think he was well prepared to deal with some of these topics because he very quickly got into the weeds of details. I think he must have taken this for granted, and I hope he will really prepare himself for the next one.
Terry, what do you think?
Yeah, he definitely needs a double espresso before he goes on next time, and somebody needs to tell him, Barack, you're on camera when you're not speaking.
That's right.
Because to me, the image out of that debate is him looking down at that Sudoku or whatever, and it's grim. And people were watching that all the time. So one is wake up, and Romney was looking at him all the time and looked engaged all the time. Romney was just totally on. So he needs to really drink some espresso and get command of his facial expressions. I know he doesn't want to be there. It sure looks like it. I wouldn't want to be there. But simplify the rhetoric. And I do think he needs to answer Romney on some of the issues. He just let the whole $700 billion in Medicare thing go, and Romney repeated it and repeated it and repeated it. And it's a complicated thing. He might not have wanted to go into it, so maybe that was conscious. But you got to call him on some of that. Romney was not letting Obama get away with anything.
Nope.
I was thinking that besides the double espresso, he probably needs a Clinton transplant.
Yeah, exactly.
Because I thought at the convention it was so clear that Bill Clinton was able to do the story about the last 4 years in a way that Obama has never been able to.
Yeah.
And do it while he looked like he was having fun.
Yes.
Well, Bill Clinton always does. well, briefly, and this is related, talking about what minds are changed as we kind of go through each stage of this campaign. We've already gotten into some early voting. Some states have started it, and as we get closer to Election Day in November, more states have kind of roll out their early voting. Any sense of what proportion of the electorate is voting early, and therefore how much does it matter that, you know, at what stage Obama's ahead or Romney's surging or anything like that? Kirk, does...
I've seen some reports the last couple of days that there's still some debate about who votes in the greater numbers early, whether it's Democrats or Republicans. But nonetheless, I think the people who vote early are clearly those people whose minds are made up. They're not the people who are putting off the final decision.
Yeah.
And so I guess I don't think the early voting will make that much difference. Maybe there's a world-changing event in the last 5 days before the election that shifts a lot of votes that won't have shifted because the people voted early. But I think in this kind of a polarized environment, the people who are voting early are in those camps that would probably not change their views for almost any reason.
Yeah, okay. Do you agree, Tony, Bill?
Almost.
Okay.
It's going to be a big early voting electorate. Yeah. About half of Californians now vote by mail, and they're demographically representative of the total population.
Mm-hmm.
Used to be on election night, we'd go down to the registrar of voters and wait for hours and hours and hours and hours, especially in Santa Clara County, and then more hours to get results. Now when the absentee vote comes in, it's over. You know exactly who's going to win. Okay, it might tweak a little bit, a really close race like Council District 10 could change, but 95% of the election is determined because that vote by mail population is much more representative than it used to be. I do think early voting is going to be to Obama's advantage. And the reason up until yesterday anyway is that he had a little more momentum going for him. Mm-hmm. Not so sure that continues now. But the other reason is he has a much more effectively organized ground campaign mm-hmm. across the country, but especially in California, we don't matter. But in the swing states, they've really got a ground campaign that will be getting those committed Obama voters out early, so they don't get demoralized by the debate performance or whatever. So I think that is to Obama's advantage, and it will be important. It's more important in every election now across the country.
It's growing. Is that what?
Yes.
Oh yeah. And
more states are allowing it. More people are doing it.
You know, it's so much easier than dealing with electronic voting machines and all of the other things. In Santa Clara County, the ballots get mailed on Monday. So the end of next week, people will start looking at things. I think the flood really doesn't start until maybe a week and a half, 2 weeks before the election. And we find out about that. We publish a list of our recommendations as we make them, add to it all the time. And
are you doing them earlier?
We are doing, oh, yes. We started in August. We started publishing. You have to because people will be voting next week. Mm-hmm. And the things that we are sure of and feel strongly about, we really get out there early. And some of the things we have some questions about, well, we're not as worried because we're not sure which way to go. But we notice people start calling us and saying, where's your recommendation list closer? And some will always say, I always want to see it because I always vote the other way on everything. And that's fine. That's fine. That's good.
As long as they want to look the paper, at it. Really. Interesting. Well, one of the issues that, especially during times of bad economies, the line is always, you know, well, in the post-Clinton era, it's the economy, stupid.
Yeah.
But during tough times, we get all kinds of the commentary at saying, you know, well, if unemployment's over, what is it, 8% or 8.1% or something, the incumbent can't win. And yet we've seen Obama slightly ahead now with over Romney, even doing better in a number of the battleground states where really the election will be won or lost. Why is this a situation of if the Republicans had a stronger candidate, they could walk away with this campaign, or is the economy not being perceived the same by the electorate as it is by the people who comment on it?
I think that people who are thinking about these things understand that this has been a different kind of recession and understand that Obama, I mean, I know Romney says he's just making excuses, but understand that he came into an extraordinary situation and things are getting a little better now. And I think people realize the stimulus programs, while they didn't, you know, the economy hasn't caught fire, they did stop a lot of people from losing their jobs. And I think that's different this time. Could be wrong. What do you think?
No, I agree with that. Also, the people who are suffering most are the people who are least likely to vote and who haven't been voting in the primaries and so on. It would have helped if the Republicans had a stronger candidate. I really think Obama was vulnerable, much more vulnerable than he's appeared over the last few months, and the Republicans did not come up with the strongest possible candidate to make that argument. He's too rich a guy. He's too labeled in that way. So I think that's a factor. And then the other thing is that a lot of people think things are getting slowly better, mm-hmm. and understand that there were deep problems we had to move away from. So I think it's a combination of those factors. But I think all of us who study elections are surprised that the economy hasn't been a more significant factor.
One other thing I'd add, I think I agree with everything that that Terry and Barbara have said. The fact that Obama spent so much money on ads early on, mm-hmm. to make the election a referendum on Romney and his understanding of the American people meant that it didn't get, mm-hmm. focused as much on the economy. And now the risk to Obama is suddenly, okay, Romney's decent, and they may now be looking for what issue to vote for, and we may see a focus back on the economy.
Mm-hmm. The Obama camp seemed to do what a lot of candidates wish they can do, which is to define your opponent before your opponent has a chance to define himself. Kind of, I guess, that happened with Dukakis, mm-hmm. to some degree with John Kerry. excuse me. Here in Silicon Valley in the Bay Area, and I actually came down from San Francisco. That's why I wore a tie. but we things are doing quite well here compared to much of the country up in San Francisco. And I don't know if it's the same down here, but real estate is booming and, you know, lots of new tech jobs and things like that. And really, Barbara, maybe more than the rest of us, do you see people around here perhaps having different interests in this presidential campaign that maybe they do in, I don't know, Arizona?
You know, it's so hard to say because this is such a Democratic area to begin with. You've really got to be some kind of Republican to get. I mean, in San Jose, we have a mayor who is, you know, a Republican for every definition except he's registered Democrat. Why? Because, you know, he wanted a political future here. So as far as people here moving substantially on a national office or on, you know, a Dianne Feinstein or something like that, this is just not a good place to look for that. This is probably going to be Democrat no matter what.
Very blue section of a very blue state.
Exactly.
Agreed.
Yes, and that means also the candidates pay no attention to us except to come and try to raise money here.
Yeah,
that's
yeah.
right.
So in terms of we don't see the ads, we don't see the campaign rallies, none of that, and we won't, because they already know what we're going to do. So we're kind of out of the loop. I would point out, though, that unemployment in Silicon Valley is 8.4%,
yeah.
which is above the national average. Ohio's actually better off at about 6%. Several of the swing states are better off in terms of unemployment. So we're putting up with something worse than the national average, and we're still happy to support this government, and for the most part, anyway, in this valley.
But we've got trillions of dollars on the sideline ready to invest in Silicon Valley if there's ever enough stability beyond the fiscal cliff that I think people here assume that our future is pretty good.
More near-term optimism that things can turn.
It's an optimistic place, yeah.
Right.
Well, let's talk about some things that do matter then in California. We're a state that likes to vote on everything, so we've got a slew of propositions. Do you care to talk about the proposition? I mean, what is there, like 11 of them, I think,
yes.
that are qualified? Do you care to talk about some of them that you find most significant, which ones you think will pass, which ones you'd like to see pass, which ones you think will be terrible if they pass? Barbara, I'm going to throw it to you.
Well, I think the most important ones on the ballot are 30 and 38, the two tax measures, Jerry Brown's 30 and Molly Munger's 38. Mm-hmm. I don't think Molly Munger's that's direct aid to K-12 schools and very direct. Money goes directly to the schools, not to the districts. And Jerry Brown's is a broader tax, raises money for schools, but also for some other things. And it's partly a an income tax surcharge on the wealthy, and it's a small sales tax, quarter cent sales tax as well.
And his is temporary, right? Is hers also temporary?
They are both temporary. His is 8 years?
I think it's seven. But
7 years, 8 years. 7 or 8 years. Hers, I believe, is 12 years.
Okay.
And hers will raise a lot more money over time, but it also creates this whole new bureaucracy. I think, you know, the terrible thing would be if nothing passes, because the state has cut and cut and cut. Mm-hmm. And you just can't, in a rational way, go on doing that without having some kind of recovery, particularly for the schools. And I think, you know, 30 is the one that has the best chance of passing and that will do the most good. Now, unfortunately, Molly, the sponsor of 38, is not just campaigning for hers, but is campaigning pretty viciously against Jerry's Proposition 30. So I think this, if they kill each other, it will be truly tragic. And I think if neither passes, we're going to see some really bad things happening in our schools.
Terry, what about you?
Well, I agree. Prop 30 is to me the most important initiative on the ballot, and that funding for the public sector, education in particular, and higher education, my own field. We've cut and cut and cut, and there's got to be something to stabilize it. This is not going to supplement things significantly. It's just going to stabilize. And we can't cut 2 weeks off the K-12 school year. My goodness, we're in international competition economically. We just can't weaken our education system any further. So I think Prop 30 is pretty important right now. It's doing okay in the polls. It's hitting 50, 51, 52% in the polls as the yes vote. They've got money. They're outspending the opposition 10 to 1, about $41 million to about $4 million. So there's going to be a lot of campaigning. But Prop 38 kind of mixes things up in a way that can confuse voters. And you know what California voters do when they get confused about ballot measures? They just vote no, which also brings me to another ballot measure that I'm interested in, and that's the, is it 40 or 41? Yeah, it's 40. It's the referendum on the redistricting.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And there's no campaign about this because the Republicans brought it up. I put it on the ballot, I think, as part of a tactic to just delay things and then decided not to spend any money on it. But if we just vote no on Prop 40, then the redistricting commission's plan is invalid and we go back to the old system, or they have to do a whole new plan. So we have to vote yes not to repeal
It's very confusing. We wrote about this early on, and we're going to come back to it next week when the ballots hit to remind people it will seem like you want to vote no on this, but you need to vote yes to keep it in place. It's very...
One of the benefits I would think of the early voting is that instead of having to read this in the voting booth and try to compare it with what I've read, you've got it at your kitchen table, and you can turn to your spouse or children or whatever and say,
or the mercury
what the
news.
Heck does this mean? Mm-hmm. And think about it, because, yeah, that's... You've just explained it, and I don't know that I understand it.
Exactly. That's not the only one on the ballot like that.
Yeah. Yes.
Kirk, any of these problems?
No, I would agree that 30 is the single most important thing. I think this is why it's in order to have 30 on the ballot that we elected Jerry Brown. We elected Jerry Brown and said, use the fact that you're an old fella who doesn't have another election to run to do the right thing. And so he's put this on the ballot and said, this is your only way of bailing yourselves out, California. And as both Barbara and Terry said, if this does not pass, we are in deep trouble. And education is going to be the greatest victim. And higher education is going to suffer dramatically, as well as the K through 12. The two-week estimate is one of the likely scenarios that we would have to shorten the school year. And I think if that can just be thrown continually in people's faces, they'll realize what's at stake here.
Because if you can get those kids out of the house for two extra weeks,
that's right, exactly.
That'd be worth it. Raise my hand. Okay.
I just would like to add that the main reason, actually, I think Jerry's measure is better than 38 is that it does also help higher education. 38 does not. It's purely K-12, and that's really important, but a lot of kids aren't getting through college.
And some
now.
Of it goes into the general fund.
Some of it goes into the general fund.
Does not have strings. It is right. Not earmarked. Doesn't have strings attached. Part of our budget problem in California is that so much of the budget is earmarked through the initiative process that the governor and the legislature don't have discretion to move it where it might be most needed.
Okay. Well, let's go in now in depth here onto some campaign ethics, whether truth lives at all in the age of these incredibly expensive, incredibly hard-fought campaigns. Kirk, you've done a lot of studying and educating the business world about ethics. When you look at the political world, are they similar temptations, similar mistakes, similar problems, or are they? Do you see different drivers in each?
Well, two comments. One is that the Markle Center that I head works in both business ethics and government ethics and medical ethics and law and ethics. So we find common patterns across them. And one of those patterns is that incentives and experiences inform how you look at decisions like this about how truthful to be. And so I sort of lined up what I thought was the perfect storm that's led us to the point where there is much more lying in campaigns this cycle than I think there has ever been. The first thing was the Florida election year 2000. Is that correct? Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yes. And that said, a few votes can make a difference. And whatever you have to do, the desperate measures taken in regard to trying to save that election, either for the Republicans or the Democrats, led us to believe, hey, when push comes to shove, anything goes. And so I think that was lesson number one. Lesson number two is that there are so many multiple players in it now, some of whom are on the Internet, many of whom are on the Internet, and the same rules don't apply. You can get away with more in that environment. Mm-hmm. Now, we've spread that so that now it's not just the candidates, but so much money is being spent through the super PACs, which, because they, quote, don't consult with the candidates, are not held to the same standard, I would argue, and therefore there's more lying by them, and we've got a lot of examples of that. But there are also interest groups. There are commentators that have now become very partisan in their commentary.
Why are you looking at me?
And then there are simply, chain emails and bloggers of all kinds who certainly don't seem to be held by standards of truthfulness. So that's the second thing, is that there are all these players who don't feel they're held by the same standard. The third thing is that the truth is often in the eye of the beholder, and people are realizing that spin can recast a fact, and you can create exactly the opposite impression without in some ways technically telling a lie.
But actually,
the impact is that you have created a lying impression.
I was going to ask that actually in the debate question, where of course you all know at these debates now for the presidential room, debates, they have spin rooms where they have all of the partisans of each candidate in there. It's like putting all the prostitutes in one red light district and keeping them there. But the journalists go in there literally knowing that everyone who's an Obama person is going to say Obama just knocked it out of the park, and everyone who's on a, it's kind of like lie to me because I have 3 minutes of airtime to fill.
Yeah. The last two things I think have brought us to where we are. One is that the last 4 years have been an incredible time for partisanship. Mm-hmm. And whether it's the Tea Party and its fervency or whether it's others, there has been a strong sense that because the other side is actually evil, that anything we do to defeat them is okay. And therefore, that is a moral justification for lying or for shading the truth or for making up things about the other side. And we've seen a lot of those examples. The last thing is simply the belief that the other side's already doing it. Mm-hmm. And if I can point to a blogger who supports Romney who's lying, then maybe I'm not going to be so tight about it if I'm an Obama speechwriter or someone working on a super PAC that is supporting Obama. So the belief that the other side is shaving the truth lends some kind of a credibility to the notion that I can do it as well. So I think all those things have contributed to make this the least truthful campaign that we've seen in a long time.
Now, I'll occasionally read a news article or see news from the United Kingdom or somewhere in Europe where a candidate will actually be disqualified. I've even seen it after the election. They will be removed from office because they lied.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think the United States is anywhere likely to go that way, but is there, do you have any, offer us some hope? Give us something to hold on to.
I have some sense of things that may mitigate it, but I don't think there's any hope of reversing it. We're certainly not going to go to the standard of reviewing after the election the fact that this candidate lied 17% more times than this one, and therefore he or she's ineligible to serve. I don't think we're going to get there. We're going to maintain our current pattern. But on the other hand, I think there are some things we can do. The first thing is exactly what Barbara was saying, that she's running in the Mercury News, or the Mercury News is running many more fact checks. Mm-hmm. The fact that newspapers in general are doing that at least gives you a source to go to say, and as she pointed out, lots of reports today on where the untruths were in last night's debate. The other thing, though, is that we voters have got to penalize the people that lie. I think if we went back 20 years and we saw someone say some of the things that were said last night, we would say that's not a person we want to serve us as our representative. And I think that outrage about morally loose behavior is not there, perhaps because of the partisanship right now, but I don't think that swings votes today, unfortunately. And I think we've got to get back to the point where we say, hey, somebody who behaves that way, who tells untruths in that way, or lets their super PACs or whatever do it, ought to be penalized.
Barbara, did you?
Yeah, I think there's another element to all this going on now, and it is a new disrespect for proof, for facts, for science. Started with global warming, and then we had the birthers. And there have been a number of things, you know, creationism. There are lots of things out there where people believe, well, what I think is important, no matter what somebody who claims to have evidence says. And the Tea Party, but also I think some liberal groups are moving more that way, and that's very frightening to me. Because it's almost beyond ethics. It's, mm-hmm. it's a core tendency that can have no good end.
Right, and to tie this in with some of what we were talking about earlier, part of our, well, the big issue with us having redistricting in this state was dealing with these pockets of concentrated people, where the people they then elect are representing such a uniform group of people that they have no incentive, for example, to go to Sacramento and compromise. And I just remember I grew up in the upper Midwest. You know, we had liberal friends and conservative friends and apolitical friends. The company I was at before I am at now, there wasn't a single Democrat. I mean, excuse me, there wasn't a single Republican in the office. Mm-hmm. It wasn't a huge office, but still, I'd never experienced that before. Mm-hmm. So we on the liberal side, on the left side, the blue side in the Bay Area, we really see that kind of echo chamber of mm-hmm. I can't believe someone doesn't believe that they should be mulching their coffee grounds after they, whatever you do with coffee grounds.
One other thing, John, that I think is important here is that we had this run-up to the presidential elections of the Republican primaries. Mm-hmm. And because there were so many candidates and they stayed in so long because of money being available to keep them in, the only way to get attention was to say something outlandish or stronger than you might feel. And therefore, the kind of statements that were made either about other Republican candidates, untruths, I would argue, or statements made about Obama that were even more outlandish than what the candidate to your right had just said about Obama, led to a "I'll raise you one" kind of atmosphere in which the truth got badly treated, mangled as people tried to get the public's attention, the Republican electorate's attention.
You've a couple times kind of circled around or tied this to money in politics, mm-hmm. and it's through the roof right now. I mean, is it glib for me to say that is money the root of all this, of the current, this flare up, if you will, this change over the last 20 years from where we would never have allowed this, you know, voted for someone like this 20 years ago to today, or are there other factors that have brought us to this great position?
I think money is still the greatest cause of the kind of elections we have today. It's because of money that we have the independent voices in the super PACs or in other unaffiliated groups, groups that are not formally affiliated with the campaigns. Mm-hmm. It's because of the ease, the low cost of participating on the Internet that we have many more voices as well. But the money allows people to use a megaphone through advertising or through other kinds of communication that simply were not there before. Mm-hmm. And in that cacophony of voices, maybe I can get away with an untruth or an exaggeration, and it won't be as noticed as it might have been when there were fewer statements by candidates and less noise.
And it filters down, right? It's not just a candidate and then the other candidate does it. It's their field operatives. It's when I say I was from the Midwest, I mean, I was from Chicago. So not a place you generally think of as, you know, ethical and political. But you generally think, okay, in the 1990s when I lived there, it was better than it was in the 50s or 60s. I actually know someone who was a judge in her ward, her district, whatever they're called, who caught someone voting with a dead person's name. The only reason she caught this was because my friend is a bit odd and would attend. She lived in downtown Chicago. She would occasionally just walk into someone's funeral, a stranger's funeral, and attend it. She happened to have walked into the funeral of this person who then had her name used, which really is just a long roundabout way of saying, A, this is not just at the top, it's all the way through, and B, it was pure luck that she was caught. Mm-hmm. So are there ways, are we at the mercy of kind of these fact-check organizations? Are there other ways of shine, you know, the sunshine is the best disinfectant. Mm-hmm. Is there some more structural way we can get that transparency throughout the system?
Well, excuse me for volunteering to answer this first, but education could be a really important part of it, and we do a lousy job. Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, our K-12 students get one semester of government in high school, one. That's it. They're in and out. In college, they may get one semester, and that's not true at every university in the state system or in the private system. So we're not educating about civic ethics, about campaigns, elections, about the importance of government. I really worry about the long-term impact of all this because I think it has two effects. One is to deepen the partisanship. So I believe what I believe. Whatever she says, I'm not going to believe it. I believe what I believe. I believe what my side believes. That's it. and I choose my media accordingly. Mm-hmm. And so that's one impact. It deepens the partisan divide, I think. The other impact is it deepens the cynicism in the system. So now I'm thinking of young people I work with again, and they're pretty cynical about politics, more than our generation, and we're pretty cynical about politics. So I think the cynicism gets deeper and deeper, and ultimately that alienates people from the political system, and they stop voting and they stop participating, unless they've locked into one of those partisan systems. So I think we're going to see voter turnout decline. I think we're going to see disengagement, and all the mistruths and the distortions just further alienate people from the process rather than drawing them in and engaging them, is what we should be doing.
Okay. I sometimes think we should have a whole program on citizen ethics, because I think what Terry's talking about our obligations as citizens to do the kind of looking into the candidates and looking into the propositions and checking on the facts is one that we've lost a bit of that citizen commitment because of the partisanship and so on.
I have not asked him to mention that, but in fact, later in October, the Commonwealth Club, we're going to be hosting Sandra Day O'Connor, the former Supreme Court Justice, and that is her big passion, is civic education, the problems we're having as a result of the fact that we don't have the classes and the institutionalized passing on of education, best practices, what to watch for, how to be careful. So.
And her primary focus is on middle schools. So hopefully that'll get them in a better mood for our college education.
Well, speaking of drawing people in, let's ask some questions here from the audience. Back to the debate, there's a question about what you thought about the debate format, but specifically the moderator. And I like the question on here of who do you think could have moderated that event and done, maybe improved the results we got from the two speakers, or were those speakers going to just talk over whatever moderator it was? Because they, you know, unless you shut off those mics, do you have any, I would just wish so-and-so was there.
I don't have a name, but I think there are any number of people who could have done it better and have done it better in the past. I was Jim Lehrer, you know, he used to be really incisive. And
was he just too differential, you think?
He was differential, and I, you know, I just don't think he had what it took to come in there and deal with that. He was completely out of control. He did not at all control the event, and it was terrible. But I'm not coming up with a name of my ideal person.
I think Jon Stewart would have been wonderful.
Jon Stewart would have been great.
No celebrity or politician who's ever been on Jon Stewart has gotten the better of him.
That's
so
true.
Well, Bea Arthur played Maud, and she's dead, so I guess I'm trying to think of somebody really authoritative. In fairness to Lehrer, it was a new format.
Yes.
And the whole idea of the format is that there would be more interaction between the candidates. And that worked.
Which I actually thought was good. They kicked the dead horse a lot, but, I mean, you got to know that horse really
well. A little
more
control would have been good, but some of what the goal was attained.
Yeah. Okay. Well, another question. I heard this comment on another news show after the Republican convention. The Republicans kept talking about the terrible economy the last few years and seemed to act as if the Republican Party came into existence only 3.5 years ago, rather than the 8 years of the Republican presidency, et cetera. How can they pull this off? Is this amnesia? Is this what? How are they making?
By keeping George W. Bush hidden in an undisclosed location.
That's right.
he was not at the convention.
No.
He was not anywhere. No.
That was very deliberate.
No.
Yeah. Okay. Well, if Obama wins and the House stays Republican, both of which are at least statistically the probabilities right now, maybe, what happens? What do you think legislation will move forward? This kind of gets to the debate you might have seen where Obama had suggested that he thought the Republicans would be more likely to deal with him in a second term. Others said, you know, dream on. What do you think?
I say dream on.
Really?
I think it's going to be a huge challenge. I think there are people in the House of Representatives who are Republicans who are prepared to deal with the president, but they can't lead their whole caucus. There's a core of Tea Party Republicans there who are totally uncompromising. And they are not going to move. And then there are all the people who have signed the Grover Norquist pledge that never to raise a tax in any form. I just think there's a core of the Republican Party that's going to be uncooperative, whatever, and their leaders can't bring them along, which is the way it used to work. The leaders
they
actually
could bring them along.
The leaders
yes.
could lead.
Used to be part of the job.
Right.
Now the job seems to be to stop the other guys from succeeding.
We'll have an early test of this with the fiscal cliff.
Yes.
Yes.
And whether in the face of disaster, which I think all of us can see what it would do in terms of jobs, in terms of military budget and everything else, there can be some compromise struck. Mm-hmm. And I think the jury's out on that.
Yeah. I mean, they almost didn't do the debt ceiling last year, and that just letting that go to the brink was a disaster for the country.
Looking at the projections on the House election and the Senate election, too, the tide has turned a little bit to the Democrats' advantage. But I think enough that they'll probably be able to hold the Senate, but I think not enough because they need too many seats to change, not enough to change who controls the House.
Will Todd Akin be in the Senate?
Maybe.
Yep.
It's Missouri.
That's where he's running, yeah.
Okay. Well, let's talk about Sacramento. Isn't it high time for the electorate to understand that politicians in Sacramento are beholden to the unions and that the unions are as much responsible for the state deficits as anything else? So when all of Jerry Brown's plans for dealing with the issues are coming out, has he taken a tough line with unions? Is he the union's candidate? I mean, he has said no to them on some things. Am I right?
Well, I'm a union member, and I wish what that questioner said was true, but I really don't think it is, certainly not for the faculty union at the state university. We have not been very successful in advocating for ourselves or for the state university system. I think Jerry Brown's done more to work with and manage the unions than any governor before him. And the pension reform, I know a lot of people think it's not enough, but it's a lot more than anybody else has ever been able to accomplished. So I would give him some credit for that, and the state legislature voted for it. So certainly there were unions that were adamantly opposed to even those minimal changes. Prop 32 is on the ballot, so there will be an opportunity for the questioner to take away the ability of the unions to raise money, and that's going to be a very hard-fought ballot measure.
I think we're going to have many more chances to test how politicians and the unions align themselves because of the pension crises in city by city in California.
Yeah.
We have not seen all of the bankruptcies yet.
Right.
And at that point, you are tested whether you're going to be held to something akin to the no taxes pledge, which is no change in the pensions, which many of the unions have advocated. I think there has to be some change, whether it has to be on the San Jose or San Diego model or what the formula is, there has to be some change. And so you're going to have to buck the union positions if you are a moderate politician or a politician who wants to take fiscal responsibility seriously.
Any comments, Barbara?
No, I think unions, public employee unions, do have an inordinate amount of influence in Sacramento, and have to a great extent here in San Jose, and I think a lot of the Bay Area. However, I also think there are very different interests, corporate interests, that also are exercising more influence now, and it becomes harder to say the unions are to blame for everything because there are new strong players there. Actually, you know, we've had concerns about union influence, but we're saying vote no on 32 because this is not the time to undercut working people's ability to influence politics when people with a ton of money are spending so much of it to influence politics.
Okay. One more question here before we get to our news quiz, and that brings us back to the issue of ethics, and we kept talking about transparency, how do we educate people about them. And someone asks, what are the implications of WikiLeaks? Of course, someone just making public information that folks don't want public. positive, negative, both? What do you think?
I've considered the WikiLeaks rationale, which is that we've got to bring out all of these secret cables in order to address the evils being done by some people in power, to be a fallacious argument. I think you have ethics is most often about balance. And so you've got to balance the desire for transparency with a desire to protect legitimate interests or concerns. And we put a lot of people at risk of being assassinated. Certainly we took down some of the capacity of the United States government to collect information around the world via the WikiLeaks. And so I'm not a believer in every person who can break into a computer system should put everything online.
Kirk, Barbara, any dissent?
Yeah, I mean, it's an uncomfortable position for me because the press, you know, publish everything. But in fact, we don't publish everything. We
try
to
you haven't.
Learn everything we can. Pardon?
Tell us something you haven't published. That'd be good.
Just we don't publish addresses of rape victims. That's we don't know or their names if they don't want them to be published. Something comes to mind. But, you know, I think of the Pentagon Papers. There was a reason to publish those, and they were after the fact for the most part, and they didn't get anybody killed. And I think when you just, without discretion, publish material because you can, you don't know where it's going to end, and the end may not be good.
I've been looking at one case which illustrates what the press does not publish. There is a newspaper in Florida, I believe it is, maybe it's in Georgia, that publishes pictures and names of everyone arrested. Mm-hmm. And so you're able to look at all your neighbors who got arrested for any reason on their website. And, of course, you know they never follow up with what was the disposition or whether this person simply got swept up, but that's forever searchable on Google. And that seems to me to be irresponsible. And yet that's become, at least as reported by their editor, their most popular section. Barbara and her newspaper have not followed that
one. We have not. Not yet.
Well, while we wait to find out if you do... let's do our quick news quiz, and I'm just going to read the questions. If you think you know the answer, raise your hand, and I'll call you out. Question number one, world leaders were urging caution after what country bombed military positions in Syria? Turkey, that's right. Turkey was responding to cross-border mortar fire from Syria into Turkey, killed 5 Turkish civilians. Question number two, California Governor Jerry Brown vetoed a bill that would have required charter schools to do what? Anyone know? Any of you?
No, we don't.
I don't.
Great.
No.
It would have required charter schools to provide free or reduced price meals to low-income students. Brown said the bill would have eroded the independence and flexibility of the charter schools. Question number three. President Barack Obama, who was criticized for being too passive in the first debate, he offered a response today to challenger Mitt Romney's pledge to cut funding for PBS and its prized character, Big Bird. Does anyone know what Obama said, what his response was? Oh, I enjoyed this. He said, thank goodness someone finally is getting tough on Big Bird. It's about time.
Yeah.
He's had it too easy, too long. Okay, next question. What did appliance company KitchenAid apologize for on Twitter? Did you see this story? Oh, apparently during the debate last night, one of its employees... Well, first of all, Obama during the debate mentioned his grandmother who died just before he became president. So one of the KitchenAid employees tweeted over the company's official Twitter account, quote, Obama's grandmother even knew it was going to be bad. She died 3 days before he became president. Yeah, she didn't say this. He apparently meant to send it out on his private Twitter account. But okay, well, sticking with social media site Facebook reached what milestone this week? 1 billion users, or I guess they're saying people who log on once a month or something. By the way, be sure to like the Commonwealth Club on Facebook. Okay, here's a bonus question. Iran has seen new public protests this week. Why are they protesting in Iran these days? devaluation. Yeah. Do you know how bad it's gotten? Yeah, I picked out a number, and it's going to be worse than this because this number is from Tuesday. The Iranian currency, the rial, I believe, it's fallen to record lows. It's currently at something like 35,500 rial to a dollar.
So, have we fact-checked that one?
I read it on the Internet. They can't put it on the Internet.
Yeah, it has to be right.
Good time to travel. Well, on that note, I have just one last question. It's not a quiz question, but I've done this other times during this campaign season. I want to get your estimation of who you think will win the election, not who you want to win, but just at this point, who are you thinking is going to win in November? So clap your hands if you think that Mitt Romney is going to win in November. Anyone? Really?
Wow.
Hmm.
Well, I probably don't need to ask the other question, which is, I'm assuming you all think President Barack Obama is going to get reelected. You don't think Ralph Nader is going to throw his hat in there? Okay. At last time we did it, there actually were a few folks who thought Romney would be it. Well, I thank all of you coming up tonight, and thank you to our panel, Barb Marshman, Terry Christensen, and Kirk Hansen, and thanks to everyone who's listening to us online. Enjoyed having you all here today. Thanks. That's our program for tonight. Have a great week.
Thank you. Good.